This is the way it feels to move through summer in Lululemon. Iconic align softness without the front seam. For our smoothest look and feel ever, summer won't know what hit it. Stretch your limits in the non-stop flexibility of the new Lululemon Align No Line Pant in select stores and at lululemon.com.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Jonathan Anderson, co-founder and CEO of CanDo.
We're changing a way that a business thinks about building its product. A single person, a single growth PM, can actually define an experiment in their head, grab a template, customize it, inject it into an application, and preview it, QA it themselves, all that kind of stuff. So it really kind of collapses what is basically a growth team into a single person. That makes it radically, well, less expensive and also much, much, much faster.
This is Jonathan. He's a tech entrepreneur on a mission. He loves tech, but can't write a line of code. He's passionate about product-led selling and has launched services, strategy, operations, and analytics teams at venture-backed SaaS startups, including Inside Squared and LaunchDarkly. Prior to startups, Jonathan worked at Bain & Company and has a Bachelor of Science and Masters of Science Engineering from Stanford University. In September 2018, he co-founded CanDo, a no-code tool that allows teams to collaboratively build the UI components needed to encourage the adoption of features, onboard users, and announce product news on a day-to-day basis. It's not just for pure-play product-led companies like Atlassian, Notion, or Loom. It's for the strivers who are trying to figure out how to adjust their go-to-market motion for this new world order. And that inspired me, and hence I invited Jonathan to my podcast. We explore what's holding a lot of software companies back from shipping products to the market and achieving high adoption rates. Jonathan shares his vision about how he aims to change that for good. He elaborates on the changes he had to overcome to build traction and what that took from a product investment perspective in terms of first principles, focus, and grit. Last but not least, he shares a do and a don't for B2B SaaS CEOs based on his own most powerful learnings. By listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, his approach to convincing a user or buyer that CanDo is exactly what they need. Secondly, how to approach getting users to start using the product and become addicted. Thirdly, their approach to turn their user base into their best sales force. And last but not least, what CanDo did differently by giving their ideal customers a name that makes them instantly recognize whether it's for them or not. Well, hi, Jonathan. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah. I mean, I got the introduction to your company, CanDo, and of course to you. I always do a review, like what the company is really all about, and it made me smile. First of all, I mean, it's the podcast for tech entrepreneurs on a mission, and your mission at the end with the company is to change how we learn at work. And then I was starting to dig into your website, and I saw a couple of things that I would have loved to have when I was in my career at Unit 4. Good stuff. So here we are. Before we start talking about your company, CanDo, a little bit about you. What drives you? What do you get energy from?
Oh, that's a great question. I think what drives me, what gives me energy? I think probably the shortest answer is I have always liked, when working in product, is actually being able to make something, defining the problem, and then actually just seeing it kind of come into being over time. I think it's probably the most enjoyable part about being a product manager is actually seeing incremental progress toward this thing that is kind of your baby. And I think I've always really loved that. So I think that's probably what gives me the most energy. Of course, being a tech CEO, there's many other parts of my job, as I've discovered. So you feel like you've gotten stretched in many different directions, some of which I'm better at, some of which I'm not as good at. But I think at the core, if I could spend my whole day doing one thing, it'd probably be around kind of core product management or product really growth experiments as a point of joy for me. So
cool. Yeah, similar to me. So we're alike. A lot of stories to talk about. Yeah, talking about the company that you found, I saw it on LinkedIn, it's for September 2018. That's about 4.5 years ago. What's the mission that you're on? We already said that, but what was the problem that you saw that was screaming for a solution like you've developed?
I think it's actually important to know that there was one big pivot after year one. So we actually first started building, the core issue is how do we basically enable enterprise applications to make it easier for their users to actually use them? And we thought that actually learning at work was kind of a core part of that. How do we help people level up as they use your product? A good example of this might actually be Gusto. I don't know if you're familiar, they're a payroll provider in the US. And as you use the product, you get better at doing payroll. And it sounds really small, but like they tell you about the key dates and you get smarter about how to issue, you know, checks at the right time. And it's really small stuff, but you just become a better worker by having used that product. And so we were trying to bring that to basically all kinds of applications. So it's not just us floundering around using something, but actually getting better as we kind of use it. All of that said, I actually first built an LMS that was supposed to be part of a product. An LMS is a learning management system.
Yeah.
And it's really a way of delivering content in a product. And it was an interesting idea, but actually a terrible business. As it turns out, overlaying like deep content like that really doesn't fit very well in an enterprise application. So, and it also has this key assumption that a business has a large course of material, lots of videos ready to go. So there's kind of two major assumptions. It both doesn't really work with the UX, and also you have to have this kind of canon of stuff ready to go. Well, actually wasn't the right flavor of business. And it was actually through one of our design partners who said, you know what, actually, like, as much as I appreciate this overlay, what I really want to be able to do is actually have my teams change the actual content that lives in the page. So not what's on top of the product, but the actual product itself, which is what led us to actually build the UX builder.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's interesting to see, of course, how things progress. You start with one problem and then you realize that it's interesting, but there's no real fit. And then suddenly you bump into what the real issue is and what the real expensive problem is in the business that you can solve maybe in a far better way. Yeah. That's the iteration part. That's the cool part about product development.
And we're very lucky that we've had investors who have kind of seen the through line and also have been excited by the new vision, which is letting really product managers build the actual product page. So that was actually really helpful for us as well.
And of course, when they invest in something, they expect the outcomes there. And when you change direction, especially when it's pretty radical, you have to kind of get them on board again. But what is the opportunity if you get this right? When people start to embrace, and product managers start to embrace CANDO, what happens? What's the before and after?
Such a good question. Fundamentally, we're changing a way that a business thinks about building its product. And so really what we're doing is we're shifting who gets to build from basically going through a sprint cycle. So a technical, a designer designs it, a PM outlines the problem, maybe a researcher, an analyst kind of creates the eventing infrastructure, and then the actual developer builds the variant. And then it gets QA'd, obviously. We're moving all of that into a single person, a single growth PM, can actually define an experiment in their head, grab a template, customize it, inject it into an application, preview it, QA it themselves, all that kind of stuff. So it really kind of collapses what is basically a growth team into a single person. That makes it radically, less expensive and also much, much, much faster. So you can actually shift to a much more iterative way of thinking about doing product. You're not waiting to change a button. You're not waiting to change a checklist step. You're actually able to go ahead and make those changes yourself and then kind of see how it influences your product direction. So it increases the velocity of how quickly you can experiment really, really, really fast, which means that you become more quantitative in kind of how you approach problems. It means you become much more open to trying experiments just because they're so much less expensive. And I think it leads to just much more agility in kind of how you approach building your product.
So you build minimum viable products inside the core product and have an ability to release that to a certain number of people.
Exactly. And then you get to learn, hey, how did this audience react to this new banner or this new onboarding flow? And then once you kind of see within the analytics how that's performing, you get to make a change to it. It's much faster iteration, but it's also much easier to branch. So it's really easy to say, hey, for new users, they'll see this. And for returning users, they'll see that. For paid plans, they'll see this. For free plans, they'll see that. And so your product, it stops being one product and it starts to become much more personalized based on persona, use case, product line, usage, all this kind of stuff that we kind of talk about. But if we're being honest, most B2B applications are kind of just a one size kind of fits some flavor. Your product becomes much more simple in some ways for that one user, but the actual complexity is much bigger. And that's why it's so hard to manage with an engineering team.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But how do you then manage that? I mean, typically, of course, the reason why a product is a product and it's standardized and it's going through a process that's vetted is to make sure it works, that it's scalable, that it doesn't go down. And I mean, all the critical, the mission critical aspects to that. Then when product managers just take over and say, oh, wait a minute, I can actually do this much better, it starts to create a life on its own. How do you keep that going? When do you decide it's released or not released?
Yeah, that's a great question. I love that we get to change the problem definition. How big is big, right?
Yeah.
How risky is risky? Yeah. There's actually, I guess, two thoughts here. One is that the hardest thing about my business is that we're introducing risk into the equation because we're saying, hey, instead of managing this through the QA team or through your development team, like trust your product and growth team to build some of this stuff. And what we found is actually, you know, obviously we have great answers to, you know, reliability and we're SOC compliant, like all this kind of good stuff that you might want. And actually, we spend so much time building UX that honestly, we probably build UX better than most engineering teams at this point with an editor. But I think being comfortable trusting a non-technical member of your team is a really, really big jump. And so I think that's an important piece. And so what we always say is like engineering teams, first of all, we're talking mostly about content, which let's get you out of the content game. You've probably more important things to work on, but also like go vet this, you know, go test this on your sandbox, go test this in production, see for yourself and see if it's working or not. And then once you feel really confident, then start to give these low maintenance level tasks over to the growth PM or the content team or the designers, right? There's probably some part of your product, some splash page that you've neglected because you've got more important things to do. And now you don't have to do it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's a good way. I mean, I remember the time that I was product manager at a product management team, you always have to wait until it's being released and then finally you can see it and see how it's really coming alive. This dramatically speeds it up, of course. But you started in 2018. I mean, the whole no-code phenomena was already there. It's been used in so many different scenarios. I mean, I've seen complete ISVs, well, platforms for ISVs to build their product on, no code or low code, seen it in the end user game. How do you position it for Candu?
Yeah, and I think this is probably the most radical thing in our company is that we've decided, well, our hypothesis is that actually the vast majority of enterprise applications are still going to be coded. As amazing as these tools like Bubble are, or one of the app builders, ultimately, you're probably not going to throw away your biggest asset, which is your technology platform. But that means that because you've made a decision at some point to code your enterprise application, or you will make that decision at some point, you're kind of all in at that point. You can't then easily say, oh, but you know, we have this new onboarding flow and I don't want to have to code that. Ultimately, if you apply no code to your product right now, it's usually in the form of a pop-up and that's kind of on top. And so what we're saying is actually, let's stop thinking about the world as this kind of either or, you're either no code or you're fully coded. Yeah. Let's think of it like you have something that's coded and we're going to start to add in almost like micro apps, really small pieces of HTML that are no code. So let's not throw the bathwater out. Let's
best of both worlds.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, cool. What I'm always interested in is to understand, I mean, how do you start? So what has been a product strategy decision that has appeared to be really impactful right now for your success?
This is such a good question. First of all, how do you start? It's complicated, right? You make assumptions, you put something out into the world and you find out that you're wrong. You run as hard as you can for a while, you get some evidence. You have to then convince yourself, oh, I made that mistake and I've got to tell everyone, my co-founder, my early customers, my investors, I messed this up. We got to figure something else out. I think for me, one really important thing for us was deciding that we're actually not a tool to help developers build better product. We're a team to get them out of the game. So a really good example of this might be allowing someone to style elements with CSS. This is a very common feature with almost all content management systems, but it basically implies that you're going to go ahead and tweak the elements that you have so that you can then, the developer will actually change them. And what we decided early on was to enable that. And it was very cool because it would automatically pick up the styles of wherever the content was injected into, but it created all these annoying bugs for the user because it would say, oh, I didn't want the button to be displayed like that. Why did it inherit all of these styles? And so one kind of key decision we made was actually to just literally cut that out entirely and put all of that customizability into a point and click style, what's it called? A style guide or style sheet, and then basically encapsulate those styles so that the other elements couldn't interfere with them. creating what we call like a shadow DOM within the page. All that is to say, now a developer is not able to change anything, which is in some ways limiting, but I think actually really empowers this non-technical user to feel confident that whatever they make will look just like that in production as it does in the editor. So I guess choosing your user is probably a key thing here.
Yeah, I think that's the right choice. Yeah, exactly. Like there are different use cases and different type of users that can do certain things in order to add value to a product. And that's what you developed for. So what has been the hardest nut to crack on this journey for you so far? We can look at it from a development perspective. We can also look at it for, let's do the development side first. Then we move to sales.
Okay, great. Happy to do both. As it turns out, who knew? Creating enterprise UX is very hard not to crack. It turns out it's a very difficult problem. And I've met so many other entrepreneurs who have tried to crack this problem before. And they're like, oh, I gave up on that business a while ago, which is very funny because you don't know how to find these people originally. These businesses don't exist anymore. But they come to you. They come out of the woodwork when they find that you're working on a problem that they've solved before. But specifically on the engineering side, the hardest thing for us to do is building a content editor.
Let me make a small interruption here. Jonathan just made an excellent remark about what helps them open up a very large market and create defensible differentiation at the same time. Instead of building yet another better development tool for developers, they decided to serve the underserved, the non-technical people that surround the product organization. They gave them a tool to make a meaningful difference beyond what a developer organization would ever prioritize. And this drives value on two sides. It distributes how value is created across the entire organization and enables product-led growth companies to be able to do the growth hack experiences they've never had time for, resulting in better adoption, better stickiness, and so on. It's a trait remarkable software companies master. They focus on the essence and then create new value possibilities. Then they get super clear who's it for and who's it not for, and that sparks predictable traction. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark in the next 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
And the reason for that, think about like rich text nodes, you're thinking about layouting, you're thinking about styling controls. And the reason that it's so hard is because we as users are used to such a high level of fidelity when it comes to design tools. If you think about Figma, if you think about Canva, if you think about Google Slides, we're so used to an extremely high level of performance and ease of use when it comes to design. And that makes sense because we've had to design this for as a solved problem. So when my engineering team comes to me and says, now we can bold a word, and I go, of course, why is that important? No one's going to be impressed by that. And they're like, well, actually, it was really hard to isolate that one part of the, I'm really glad to hear that, but no one's going to care about that because that's table stakes, you know? As it turns out, we probably had a year of this type of stuff getting up to a level where you could actually use the product in a way that made it more seamless. And that's just a part of the journey, is being able to meet the level that already exists before you can even innovate. Yeah,
that's a good segue there too. I mean, in my book, I write about remarkable software companies don't aim to be different, not just better. And what I'm always fascinated by is like, how do you build defensible differentiation inside your product? And that is really going up. How do you go beyond table stakes? What have you done there? First of all, do that. Of course, you need to do table stakes first. But then how do you kind of get to the point where you create something that is hard to catch up on? I mean, sometimes I see websites from SaaS vendors out there and they differentiate with one particular feature. And you can already see that when the competitor sees the feature on the website, it's okay, next sprint, we got it as well. How do you create that distance? Have you thought that through?
Yeah, I think about it mostly from the perspective of how do you ensure that a customer doesn't churn out on you because they can switch over to something else. Yep. But I do think this is a general, like, interesting exercise. The way that we've thought about it is, well, first of all, we've gone maybe too far down the path of making it look pixel perfect, which most no-code tools are not able to accomplish. So we've gone really, really far in the direction of making it really easy to create very complex UX patterns, things like carousels and step-by-step flows and locked steps, all kinds of interesting things, flows that the user is able to design. So I think we actually just do some innovation on terms of the actual like creation of UX. Most people are in the world of creating content and we've really kind of pushed the envelope there. But when it comes to actually someone, I guess, switching to something else, what we found is as long as we get installed, as somebody starts to actually add the product somewhere, and then we have some of this iterative usage where someone sees how their content's performing and then makes some changes to it and continues to kind of tinker with it, we're locked in. Because not only does our design now have, like, the actual UX is quite performant, you know, maybe users are activating or people are converting or people are upselling or whatever the core reason it's there is going well, but you've also built in the pattern and habit that your team can now use it to kind of achieve those outcomes. I think that's very seductive for a lot of teams because you said people are smart, you know, oh, this onboarding thing is working over here. We're launching a new feature. How can I use that, right? How can I borrow this knowledge that now we have in the company for really how to drive these outcomes? Yeah. And so I think there's a little bit of behavior change that's really helpful when it comes to kind of locking someone in, because again, it's very empowering for this group, this new like non-technical group, to be able to achieve these outcomes themselves.
Exactly.
Without engineering time.
Yeah. It's not done before. And now suddenly you can.
You can do it. You can do it. There you go.
Exactly.
There you go. Branding.
Exactly. That's smart as well. Kind of looping back. September 2018, you started building the product. There's a pivot at some point in time. Mm-hmm. The product is now what it is. What have you learned in the sales process? I mean, at what point in time did you see, wait a minute, now we're getting traction?
Yeah. Well, we can always get more traction. We're never against traction. But no, we've got some really, really amazing customers now. We have some Fortune 500s. We have lots of startups. But actually, our core is what we call like the product-led growth companies. Companies like Gorgeous and Vidyard and companies that are just truly good at kind of creating growth experiments and have a growth squad. So that's kind of our bread and butter. And I think finding that ICP or kind of that sweet spot for us was really, really valuable. We've tinkered with the sales process a lot. It turns out when you have a new product that you're bringing to the market, people don't know how to buy it. They don't know how to evaluate it and they don't have a budget for it, right?
Yep.
It's hard. If you're a better mousetrap, if you're able to deliver an existing thing in a better way, I think it's much easier because you can undercut on price, because people have to find budgets, because you can switch over. When you're bringing a whole new thing to the market, you really need to, especially with an enterprise buyer, you really need to figure out how do we communicate value and how do we demonstrate value in an evaluation? So one thing that we've actually figured out is that as cool it is for me to talk about how great it is to create UI, and this is a little bit counterintuitive, but I actually love to create something that they already have in their product and say, hey, you coded this, you hard coded this, but actually here's how you would make it with Can Do. And here's how you can now edit it. Does that create value for you? No, you already have that in your product. It's not creating any new value for you. But it makes it super clear that this is a new way of doing a thing that you've done that's been very painful and slow in the past. That's one example of kind of one of the ways that we've changed how we sell. It's not about the next new thing that you've been dying to build, but it's actually, here's what you already did.
Yeah, but that's what people have a context to.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally.
But possibly, especially if it happened like 3-4 months ago, it's still very fresh.
Yes, you know? Yes.
All the nightmares they had to go through.
It's very fun to be able to say, hey, you have this beautiful homepage of your product or this dashboard or this onboarding flow or even a new page. Oh, by the way, here it is live. I made this in maybe a day or two. And if you want to make a change to it, if you have a new product that you're launching or whatever it is, you can do this yourself. I mean, here's how to do it.
You already made a point about sales-led growth versus product-led growth companies. Why do you believe it's the product-led growth companies where these guts that are waiting far more for this?
Yeah, it's such a good question. We enable you to become more product-led as an organization because we make it, again, so much less expensive to launch new experiments. And that's the main thing with product-led growth is that this is not necessarily functionality, right? Enterprise applications are all about functionality, right? Let's check a box on an RFP. We can do X, Y, Z, nth degree, right? Product-led growth companies are about doing one thing really, really well. One kind of clear job to be done. And that means that they're trying lots of little experiments to enable, you know, these different, usually 1 to 3 use cases. What we found is that product-led growth companies will have an Excel spreadsheet of like 19 growth experiments that they've thought about or that they've liked in other businesses that they just don't have the bandwidth to do right now because it's really hard to justify working on an experiment versus something that you know will work, aka functionality. And that's kind of our sweet spot is like things that you think are a good idea, but that customers aren't necessarily asking you for yet.
For product-led growth companies, that's bread and butter, but also their lifeline. Like you say on your website, or I think I've heard it on a video, improve your product until it sells itself. In a sales-led motion, it's more top-down sell. Mm-hmm. Something is adopted, someone signs the agreement, and it's being deployed, and people have to use it.
Right.
Different ballgame.
Yeah, and also you can talk about it. You can say, hey, here's why this is valuable. Here's how you can enable people. Here's how you're going to use it. In the product-led growth game, you literally cannot afford to do that. You can't spend salespeople on it. You can't spend CS people on it. It's the ACVs, the average contract values don't support it. So your product needs to kind of be able to step up and help users get going. And so if I can, what we tell people is that in most cases, you can improve your activation rate by about 20% by using CanDo. For an enterprise application, maybe they don't care about that. That might not be that important to them, right? And that might not be tied to revenue for them. But for a product-led growth company or a company making that transition, it's a game changer, right? That's a huge amount of value that we're able to create for them.
Exactly. That's what it's all about. And then it becomes mission critical. And then even if there's no budget, budget will be there. Was there a special moment where you felt there was a tipping point?
I think quite the opposite. I think there's been so many moments when I thought we're tipping and then we tip back, you know?
Okay.
I think there's so many false summits in the world of entrepreneurship because you get your first big contract, you get your first sales hire, you get your, maybe this is sales oriented, but you know, you do your demo day or whatever it is. There's so many moments when you think that you've made it. And then you get a little bit more data and you're like, actually, like maybe that worked okay, you know? For me though, I think a good example is we just launched this better analytics in our dashboard. So now you can see, users can really easily see how many content views they have, how their content's performing in terms of usage, and then how many people are interacting with it. And I think it's been really nice to be able to say, oh my God, I can log into an account and just see the efficacy of all of these different experiments that are running. That is like very impactful, at least for me, because it's just fun to see, you know, oh, this company has millions and millions of users and their product is now better because they're now using our product to enable this product growth team to make all these great choices.
Yeah, that's for sure. Exactly. Is there any virality I can almost imagine that. Yeah, virality becomes a factor inside your product where people get so excited about what they're now able to do in those growth teams that it has an effect. And possibly also with the end users that are using those tools again, that they say, hey, wait a minute, there's ways that I can apply this to maybe other products that we are using.
Yeah, I think within a company, it's really fun to see it jump from team to team. We were just talking give an example of like Salsify has, you know, just made a new acquisition. They're using it in one product line. They're like, oh, we'd love to have some of this, you know, onboarding components in over here. And again, who knows where that one will go, but it's fun to kind of see different teams light up within an organization. They can now kind of use it. The virality piece, I wouldn't say we've cracked it yet by any stretch. We do now kind of allow people to kind of publish content they made that they're happy about as a template, which is very, I think, inspiring to see, oh, a team over here is done. Now I can copy it over and try it for myself. And then I think we'll be launching a kind of a user community Slack coming up very soon, which I'm also very excited about, so that people can start to talk to each other. Because I think it's one thing to see an outcome, but it's very much different to kind of talk to a creator about what
they've made. Exactly. Yeah, it's peers. Yeah. And like, how do you use a product? Because it's all about creativity. The fact that you have a tool that can do a number of things doesn't mean that you have the creativity to apply
100%.
And one idea inspires the other.
Yes. I'm actually so glad you brought this up because I think I love that we kind of inspire creativity. I love having a builder tool that you can make so many different things with it. But if we're being honest, that's not for everybody, right? Sometimes people just want something that they can log into. They know exactly what to do and they can get it done. Our best users are still the problem generators. They're still the idea generators. They're thinking about a million things. They're prioritizing stuff. They're really organized. They're always looking at new products and kind of discovering what's great. And they kind of want to repeat it. I also want people who are maybe a little bit less fanatical to be successful, right? And I think for that, it's going to be a little bit more about like, what do we know is working over here at this account that we can then kind of suggest for you over here? That's actually why we have the CanDo.ai as our name. That's where the AI comes in. It's supposed to be suggestive of how to build better UX over time.
Okay.
And so we're starting to, now that we have enough data from, you know, 40, 50, 60 enterprise accounts, now we can kind of say, hey, here's what works, here's what doesn't work.
That's where the power of the force comes in.
I think so.
Yeah, you can try things out yourself. And I've talked to many customers. Last week, I was in Germany on an annual event, and they were talking about a couple of examples whereby their developers went to customers or their consultants went to customers, and they got shown things about what these people had been able to do with the product. They were like, I wasn't even thinking it was this good.
Totally.
Far future be possible, and you did it. So,
we're building that. I think you want to make sure your product succeeds in single player mode first, and then you want to think about collaboration, right, within an organization, and then you want to think about how do we cross pollinate a little bit? How do we inspire folks who are not in the same organization? One thing I love thinking about is kind of network effects, and how does each new user who comes into kind of using your product benefit from the learnings from other users? And so we actually use templates a lot for this to say, hey, here's the UI that we know works well for different kind of core use cases that's been kind of battle tested. So that when you now come into, in our case, you know, log into CanDo, you can say, oh, if I'm building a free trial, what are the kind of the core things that I'm going to need to be successful with this? If I'm trying to improve product education, and want to do contextual help, what are the kinds of UI elements that are going to be the most successful for me? And so I think that's kind of a fun exercise, which is, again, by using my product, how am I getting better at the job that I'm doing? So kind of getting back to Gusto, right? How do we help people with payroll? For us, is how do we help you build a better application?
Yeah. Well, first of all, this has been the reason why I started this podcast. This is all about the augmentation type use cases, whereby what value can we create when technology and people blend in the right way? Fantastic example. I've actually also used Gusto as a number of cases also in my daily blogs as an example of how can you make a product that is completely not sexy, like payroll?
Could not be less sexy.
Oh my God. These guys have really nailed it from that perspective. I mean, it's the showcase for everybody that's in enterprise software to look at how things can be done differently. So glad you bring it up. So I already referred my book, which is about the 10 traits that define those software companies, those SaaS companies that we start talking about and keep talking about. Always interested to hear guests on my podcast explain, what are you steering for in order for that to happen?
Sorry, help me understand that question a little bit more clearly.
What do you steer for? What do you orchestrate for in your organization to become a company that people start talking about and keep talking about?
It's funny. We finally are at the stage where we're starting to get a lot of our pipeline is from referrals from folks who've kind of used the product before and had success with it. And so I think it's fun to like hear how they talk about the product. I don't want to say that we've cracked demand gen as a function yet. I certainly wouldn't say that. But we are, I think, starting to change the conversation around, does everything in a product in the page need to be coded? And I think one thing that's been a little bit exciting for us is that now we're starting to have some competitors. There's been some more startups in the space that are doing it and innovating. There's some bigger companies who have launched competing products. Like a great example would be Braze, kind of launched something similar. And I think it's kind of interesting to see this slow transition toward allowing more flexibility in the UI and kind of how we're kind of, I guess, part of that trend or at least pushing that trend forward. And so I think for us, we've, I think, maybe benefited from a tailwind of people wanting to become more product-led. And this is a great way to do that, enable it. Yeah. But also, like, we're really pushing the message of, hey, if you are a PM or in growth or in design and you have a good idea, maybe you mock something up in Figma, there's actually the space between having that as a design and having that as real HTML that someone can interact with and you can learn from is not so far. We're going to really help push that forward for you. And then you can brag about it because you made something that's cool and drives meaningful outcomes for your business.
How do you make sure that people do brag about it?
Okay, well, let's get into the nitty-gritty then. So what do? We publish creator showcases so people can see what you've worked on. And what this means is that I have an amazing logo list because in most cases, when you write a case study, it's very involved and you got to involve two marketing teams. You have to say, hey, you know, please, you know, hey, here are the outcomes we had. Can you please check that they're real and make sure the quotes are good and yada, 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 yada. We've made the bar really low because we're like, hey, forget about Adobe or IBM or whatever made this. Let's just talk about you, individual creator. What did you make? Did you make this little banner and you're happy about it? Great. We're going to publish that as something that you've created. Oh, by the way, you happen to work at one of these amazing companies and this is live in their product. And that's fantastic. We're very excited about that. We've kind of circumvent the full case study because we're not talking about the account. We're talking about the person and kind of what they've made. And it's their network. They're posting it to LinkedIn. They're happy about it. Yeah. So that was one hack.
No, but it's a real one. And it's very underrated. I actually had a conversation about it with a customer today about exactly that. And it was about the distinction between should we do testimonials or anecdotes? And this is about anecdotes. What's the moment last week, this month, where this product helped me make a difference and I was proud of it? Like, wow.
Yeah.
Everybody can tell stories like that.
Yes. Yeah. And I love that. And that's, I think what I'm referring to is more of overcoming the hurdle of getting someone else's marketing department involved. But I think when you make it really personal, you know, here's how Kat from People Data Lab solved this problem. She is one of my favorite growth experiments ever. She has two different audiences to log into her product. And she made this really simple UI card that says, I'm familiar with an API or I'm not familiar with an API. And then based on that information, she then augments the getting started checklist to make it more technical or less technical. It's a really small idea, but I think a lot of us struggle with our problem of having really different types of people log into our product. And it drove great activation outcomes for them. But I think these types of stories are the kinds of things that help us, again, get inspired by what's possible, but then also think, oh, wait, hold on. This could apply to my product, right? I can actually do this. And I think that's the big shift is that something that was not my job, could become my job.
And who then cares about, I mean, the testimonials are always, we were great to work with and the product was installed on time and it has developed whatever type of value. These are the things that actually say, okay, well, we're actually using it. This is what magic we create with it. which is far more convincing for people to say, I want to have that as well. It's a great example. Thanks for sharing that. Looking at the time, last question here. From your journey being co-founder and CEO of Candu, the lessons that you've learned, what would be a do and what would be a don't in terms of an advice that you could give to peer CEOs, to people that want to, that aspire to kind of go on a similar type of journey and create change?
Wow. I feel so ill-equipped to give someone advice on their own journey. I can only speak to my experiences.
Yeah, well, that's what I asked for, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. Okay, let's just be totally honest. If you want to be an entrepreneur, it is going to be a tough road. It is a difficult thing to do. Ultimately, the level of risk is very high. And the further you make it, the more expectation will be on you to make sure that you deliver for your team or for your investors or for your customers. I think understanding how difficult it can be, I think, is really a key part of it. Because I think a lot of us kind of go into this blindly. I'm certainly like a, let's go out and make something, right? I have a blind optimism, which has been very helpful for me. And then I'd say the anxiety has caught up with me over time as I've learned to grapple with this big job. So I think a do for me would be find a peer group of people that you can really talk openly and honestly with, who are kind of going through a similar thing. I benefited a lot from having a strong network. And I think relatedly, it's very, very, very important to find people you can really trust, both inside of your company. In my case, it's obviously my co-founder and my team, as well as our investor group. Because, you know, things will go well, they won't go well, it'll be a mix. And I think having that, those relationships be really solidified is really, really important, and really invest in that. It seems silly. It doesn't feel like it's like a hard thing. You know, it's not a new customer logo. It's not a new technology improvement. But I think actually spending time building that network of people who are kind of facing similar things would be invaluable. And then in terms of a don't, I think make sure that you're on the same page with your team about how you fight about things. It helps to be very clear on, hey, we're having a disagreement right now because we disagree on the points here, but you can convince me by finding X, Y, and Z or whatever. I think being unclear with your team about how serious an issue is and then taking it personally can be really challenging. And people have just such different working styles. Some people are sensitive, some people are not sensitive. It happens to be that my co-founder and I are relatively insensitive when it comes to like arguing. So we're very open about having conflict is fine because we both know and respect each other. But I think being clear with the people you're working with about where they are in that spectrum is actually quite valuable. Yeah, I'm not sure that's a good do's and don'ts, but
no, maybe,
collected, course, collective wisdom, bad, I guess.
It comes up as something that you've been challenged with, and do with it what you want to do with it. You know, I'm not saying
totally.
But think about it. And as long as you know the reflection, and that's also why I write daily reflections on this business. Reflections are, to make you grow. Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for this. Where can people find out more about Candu? And how can people connect with you to say hi?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, no, please come check out Candu, CANDU.AI. Poke around, take a look at all the amazing things you can build for your product. And then if you want to chat with me, drop me a line. We use, drop me, chat with us on the website or find me at jonathan@candu.AI. I'm more than happy to chat with you about UX, about, I guess, entrepreneurship or anything else.
Cool.
The door's open.
Well, thank you very much, Jonathan. Love the journey that you're on. I like the niche that you've picked and the revolution that you're building there, really taking things forward-facing look. It's good that companies are now seeing it and trying to catch up with you. I'm going to follow you on your journey. And yeah, who knows whether we'll be on the podcast in about 2 or 3 years again.
Fantastic. I can't wait. Looking forward to
it. Exactly.
Thanks so much for the great questions and the great interview, Tom.
It was a pleasure. And this ends my conversation with Jonathan. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Jonathan Anderson, co-founder and CEO of Candu. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect Tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.